It's Scott on Tuesday, February 10th, and I am reading some senior information. This comes from the AARP magazine, which is published for January of 2026. This is an article entitled Natural Cures for Jangled Nerves. Proven ways that you can calm your anxiety, focus your mind, and free yourself from dread. The author is Victoria Mazes. She is a physician, and this story is actually an excerpt from a book she wrote. It is reprinted in this article by permission of Simon & Schuster. She is the executive director of the Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine, as well as a professor of medicine at the University of Arizona. Anxiety is part of the human experience. It transcends age, gender, socioeconomic status, cultural backgrounds, and even celebrity. Back in 1967, while she was performing a concert in New York Central Park, Barbara Streisand bungled the lyrics to several of her songs. Her anxiety was so great, what if she forgot the lyrics again, that she didn't perform in front of an audience for another 27 years. The good news is that the same brain that creates anxious thoughts can also subdue them. Here's how you can quell your unease. Harvard Business School researcher Dr. Allison Wood Brooks subjected study participants to a series of stressful tasks and instructed them to say, out loud, either I'm anxious or I'm excited or nothing at all. The excited participants performed better every time. Just by saying I'm excited, you can transform your anxiety into enthusiasm. Something called cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, teaches people to change their negative thought patterns to more effectively manage their emotional responses. To get started, identify anxiety-provoking thoughts. Sometimes we run from anxious thoughts and feelings. Recognizing and acknowledging them can make them more manageable. Challenge these thoughts. Ask yourself, is this anxious thought based on facts or on assumptions? Are there other ways to look at this situation? What might I tell a friend who had this same thought? Develop more positive thoughts. For example, instead of thinking, this project is going to be a disaster, you might reframe it as, there certainly are going to be challenges, and I'm going to plan carefully and ask for support. Practice mindfulness. Anxiety is almost always focused on an uncertain future. Mindfulness means paying attention on purpose in the present moment. When we're anxious or fearful, our breathing can become erratic, shallow, and fast. If you can't calm your breathing, try to hum, chant, or sing. These actions activate the vagus nerve, which is the long cranial nerve that extends from your brainstem all the way to your pelvic floor and plays a crucial role in stimulating the part of your brain that controls anxiety. Speak to your doctor first, but consider supplements. Many supplements can interact with prescription medications. B vitamins are vital for the production and regulation of neurotransmitters, which play significant roles in mood regulation. One study found that people who took 100 milligrams of vitamin B6 every day for a month reported less anxiety and less depression. I recommend the full complement of B vitamins, which is often sold as B50. Omega-3 fatty acids, including EPA and DHA, support brain health and reduce anxiety, but people often do not take a sufficient dose. One meta-analysis found that those taking at least 2,000 milligrams of EPA and DHA daily saw reduced overall anxiety levels. A dose below 2,000 milligrams did not achieve this effect, however. Choose an omega-3 supplement with EPA and DHA in about a 1-to-1 ratio. Kava has active ingredients called kavalactones, which can help relieve anxiety, protect neurons from damage, and improve sleep. I always have kava tea with me. Lavender, diffused or inhaled directly, can have immediate calming effects. While most essential oils aren't meant to be taken orally, one exception is lavender, in a formulation called Silexan. It has been found in studies to reduce anxiety levels comparable to benzodiazepines. The standard dose is 80 milligrams daily. It is safe, however, to take up to 160 milligrams per day. Inositol is found in small amounts in fruits, beans, grains, and nuts, and can be taken as a supplement to treat anxiety and panic attacks. I usually have people begin with 3 grams and slowly increase their dosage to approximately 12 grams. Magnesium supplements have been found to effectively reduce anxiety. I recommend 400 milligrams daily of magnesium citrate or glycinate. I also recommend a hot bath with 1 cup of Epsom salts, which is magnesium sulfate, added to your bath water. The magnesium from the Epsom salts is absorbed through your skin. Adaptogens are a unique class of herbal medicines that help the body adapt to stress. I frequently recommend ashwagandha, which helps reduce anxiety, lowers cortisol levels, and can also improve sleep. The dose is 300 milligrams twice daily. Download some anxiety-busting apps. I recommend Mind Body apps to virtually every patient I see. There are many to choose from. I especially like Insight Timer, which has more than 300,000 free guided meditations, as well as a paid subscription option, and Unwinding Anxiety, which costs $29.99 a month, which was developed by a psychiatrist, Dr. Judd Brewer. Get under a weighted blanket. A meta-analysis found that 63% of people using them reported a reduction in anxiety symptoms. Per studies, the ideal blanket weight can be up to 10% of your body weight. And finally, try a vagus nerve stimulating device. Sensate is a palm-sized device you position over your sternum that works by toning the vagus nerve, a master controller of anxiety, and I've found it highly effective for my patients who complain of anxiety. Another vagus nerve-stimulating device is AlphaStim, which clips onto your earlobe. It's available online and at some VA medical centers. GammaCore is a third vagus nerve stimulator that can deliver mild electric signals to the neck. It's been FDA cleared for migraines. An important note, if you have a pacemaker or other implanted device, be sure to check with your primary care doctor before using any of these devices. This story is entitled, Why We Told Our Kids All About Our Money and Why Sooner is Better Than Later. The author is Cameron Huddleston, who is the editor of Mom and Dad, We Need to Talk, How to Have Essential Conversations with Your Parents About Their Finances. When should you tell your kids all about your finances? When should you open up about your accounts, your bills, and your estate plan? Is it after an emergency? Is it when you're having trouble managing your paperwork? I'd say the right time to tell them is right now, if you haven't done so already. It's never too early. Here's what my husband and I did. One Friday night, a year ago, we sat down with our 2 daughters, 18 and 20, to go over all the details of our assets. That included our long-term care plans and our wills. By sharing all this with children barely out of high school, I'm guessing we're probably outliers. Although 89% of high net worth baby boomers in a recent survey said it was important to tell their heirs about their inheritances, fewer than 40% had actually done it. Having these talks can be painful, according to Tim Prosh, who's author of the AARP book, The Other Talk, A Guide to Talking with Your Adult Children About the Rest of Your Life. That's especially true, he writes, when you come to the part about the various stages of your deterioration. And, of course, that last sentence, the end. But avoidance can leave your children confused, frustrated, and even resentful if they have to handle your finances while flying blind. I had strong motivation for not waiting. My father died at 61 of a heart attack. That's when I learned he didn't have a will, something that shocked me since he was an attorney, he was on his second marriage, and he had children from his first marriage. My mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease at 65. As she began to decline cognitively, I had to dig through her files, intercept her mail, and play detective to get the kind of information I needed to manage her money. In addition, my husband and I had recently updated our estate planning documents, naming our daughters as our alternate executors for our estates, as well as our healthcare surrogates and our agents under power of attorney. We didn't want to saddle our kids with these responsibilities without explaining what those roles entailed. Finally, just days before sitting our kids down for the talk, I learned that a high school classmate's wife had died in her sleep. She was 52. I was 51, and my husband was 50. As I see it, these conversations cannot wait until parents reach some arbitrary definition of old. And advisors agree. The conversation usually should start when the adult children are in their 20s, because accidents can happen to parents, even though the parents may only be in their 40s or 50s. That's according to Daniel Lash, who's a partner at VLP Financial Advisors in Vienna, Virginia. We started off by telling our daughters what to do if my husband and I die at the same time, since then they would be our co-executors. We told them the value of our life insurance policies, the process for collecting death benefits, and how much we have in our financial accounts, of which they are the beneficiaries. We said that our wills divide everything evenly among them and their brother, Alexander, who was then 13. We've shared general information with him about our money, but not in the same detail we told his sisters. We also explained how the person designated as Alexander's guardian would manage the money that he inherits. Then we told our daughters what they'd need to know about our finances if we were unable to manage them on our own because of cognitive decline or another health issue. We listed for them all the monthly bills we pay and all the accounts we have. We told them that we have enough savings to cover the cost of long-term care and that we don't expect them to provide hands-on care for us. We explained that as our alternate healthcare surrogates and agents under power of attorney, they'll be able to make medical and financial decisions for my husband or me if one of us is no longer around to take care of the other. We showed them where our estate planning documents are located, along with our car titles, house deeds, passports, marriage certificate, and birth certificates. And we put all this information in writing for the two of them, including their questions. Our conversation lasted more than 2 hours. I have some tips for having that talk with your kids based on my work managing my mother's finances and on numerous interviews that I've conducted, mostly for the book I wrote, inspired by that experience. Consider rehearsing what you plan to tell your kids and anticipating what questions they might have. That's a suggestion from John Cooper, senior private client advisor with Greenwood Capital in Greenwood, South Carolina. Don't blindside them. Let them know you want to have a family money talk. If you're uncomfortable revealing as much as my husband and I did, start out small, say by telling your kids what financial accounts you have without disclosing dollar amounts. Some information is better than no information, according to Margarita Cheng, who is the CEO of Blue Ocean Global Wealth in Gaithersburg, Maryland. The more information you share, though, the better prepared your children will be in case of your death or an emergency. It would be extremely helpful for you to create a list of your assets, accounts, monthly bills, insurance policies, medical information, locations of estate planning documents, and contact information for any financial and legal professionals that you work with. You can also use this occasion to talk about the roles you expect your children to play in your care and finances as you age, why you made certain estate planning decisions, and what your final wishes are. Thanks to our professions, my husband and I felt comfortable tackling this on our own. He is an economics professor, and I am a financial journalist. Our kids have been subjected to discussions about money for years. But if disclosing all this would be tricky for your family, consider working with a financial or legal professional who can easily serve as a moderator. You might discover that family money talks aren't really that difficult. After our family talk, I asked my daughters whether the conversation had been depressing. Both of them said no. The opposite, in fact, was true. "There's not going to be a better time for a conversation like this," one told me. "It makes me happy that you care enough about your lives and our lives to do this." This story is a column entitled, "This is 70. The headline is, "The Summer After My Fall, A New Sense of Vulnerability and the Search for the Grace to Deal with It." It's written by Chip Brown. He's 72 and the author of two books. He's written for numerous national magazines, including Outside and National Geographic, as well as for the New York Times. "Until I missed a step and fell last June at the end of a vacation in Venice, I'm ashamed to say I was mystified to the point of exasperation by the prevalence of falls among older people. I wasn't unsympathetic, just baffled. Who were all these geriatric klutzes, and what was the matter with them that they were toppling over like scythed wheat? My 96-year-old mother, for instance, never an exceptional athlete, she called to say she'd had a fall in her apartment. An X-ray at the clinic subsequently showed a hip fracture, so she'd be going to the hospital for a 40-minute surgery. 4 days later, still in the hospital but now with pneumonia, she called her kids to say she'd had enough, was declining antibiotics, and removing her oxygen mask. She died that evening. Or my father, who was an athlete. In his 40s, he once won an Irish blackthorn cane for coming in second in a walking race in New York City. He was still playing golf and tennis and croquet when, 5 years before my mother, he fell. I'm not sure why or how, but before he died, he had lost even the ability to stand up. And my father-in-law, the injuries from a fall in 2011 culminated in his death a month later. My relatives are, or were, in good company. None of their stories would surprise gerontologists. Falling turns out to be the leading cause of injury for people over the age of 65. 1 in 4 older Americans reports they have fallen, and 1 in 10 falls leads to a serious injury. Preventing falls, detecting falls, and managing falls is a multi-billion-dollar business. The reasons we fall as we get older aren't all that esoteric. They range from vision problems and foot pain to vitamin deficiencies, general weakness, and balance issues. Uneven steps are also a common culprit. Not that I was thinking about any of this as I lay on my side, holding my right knee and cursing. I'd gotten up at 12:30 in the morning to unjam a stuck bathroom door that wasn't stuck but just opened out, not in. Gotta love Italy. Having solved that non-problem, I started back to bed. I skipped flawlessly down the first 3 steps of the staircase and then abruptly found myself sprawled on the floor, with pain knifing my right knee. I'm still not sure how it happened, and I had the whole summer and fall while recuperating to think about it. That night, I just knew I couldn't walk, and I was as scared as I'd been in years. Back in the U.S., I did not think of seeing a doctor until the obligatory male 10-day period of pretending nothing's wrong that won't fix itself had passed. I finally got an appointment with an orthopedist who said, "You've torn your right quadriceps tendon, you need surgery, and a minimum of 8 weeks of physical therapy if you don't want to limp around like Captain Ahab for the rest of your life." So, I passed my first summer as an invalid. I no longer look askance at the abundance of geriatric klutzes. My name is on the top of the list. It's another comeuppance, another of those rude awakenings that press home the mortal reality of life that most of us assiduously turn away from. It's humbling in so many other ways, not just the physical constraints, but the emotional vulnerability, the swallowed pride of acknowledging dependency, of needing to ask for help. Help getting something to eat. Help putting on a sock. Help not being terminally glum that I may not fully recover the mobility I had before and be able to do what I had heedlessly taken for granted. Things that once seemed like chores, bagging the garbage or even walking the dog, suddenly look like privileges. It takes just one fall to bring you closer to the truth that sooner or later, everything falls. Leaves, trees, lions, fathers, mothers, families, friends, all falling in falls, great and small. Hemlines, empires, stars. Recently, I came across a Japanese proverb that said, "Fall seven times, rise eight." That seems a bit extreme. Why make a habit of it? As my summer as an invalid ripened into fall, I would say this instead. Fall one time, and bless whatever you believe in, if you can rise at all. This is a feature story entitled Big 5-0. It's a list of folks who are celebrating birthdays, or did celebrate them, at the end of December. We start with Tiger Woods, whose birthday was December 30th. He turned 50. Golf legend Tiger Woods has been a star player from the start. Eldrick Woods was born in Cypress, California, to his father Earl, a retired U.S. Army officer, and Katilda, who was originally from Thailand. They nicknamed their son Tiger in honor of a friend of Earl's, a South Vietnamese colonel who shared the same nickname. Woods began playing golf as a toddler and was so impressive that at a very young age he appeared on the old Mike Douglas show and That's Incredible. In 1994, Tiger Woods joined the Stanford University golf team. He turned pro just 2 years later. Woods was rated the number one golf player in the world for the most consecutive weeks, 281, and most total weeks, 683, in history. In 2019, Tiger Woods became the second oldest golfer to win the Masters when he was age 43. His comment on aging? "The fire still burns to compete," Woods said in 2024, "but the body just won't recover like it used to. But that's part of an athlete's journey." Other important milestone birthdays you might be interested to learn about. Jeffrey Wright. The Emmy and Tony-winning actor starred in 2025's The Phoenician Scheme. Jeffrey Wright turned 60 on December 7th. Gina Davis. The actress wrote and illustrated The Girl Who Was Too Big for the Page, a children's book. She's also a Massachusetts native and a Boston University graduate. Gina Davis turned 70 on January 21st. John Lydon, who's better known as former Sex Pistol lead man Johnny Rotten, he launched a 2025 tour with his new band called Public Image Limited. Johnny Rotten turned 70 on January 31st. The legendary Bette Midler. The entertainer has been active lately with the New York Restoration Project, a nonprofit she founded. The singer and actress turned 80 on December 1st. Dolly Parton. The singer's Imagination Library, which gives free books to kids, celebrated 30 years in 2025. Dolly Parton turned 80 years old on January 19th. And finally, actor Alan Alda. He recently made a cameo in The Four Seasons, which is a new Netflix series based on his 1981 film of the same name. The legendary actor Alan Alda turned 90 on January 28th. I'm Scott. It's been good to be with you here on February 10th, reading from the AARP magazine of December 2025 and January 2026.